Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
What it would be like to keep bees in your backyard, or brew your own beer? Or wondered how the heck a 3D printer actually works? Curiosity killed the cat, the saying goes. But we wonder anyways. Humans are inquisitive by nature. How can we find the answers to these questions? Ah, the good old YouTube spiral. Start out searching for brewing tutorials and end up learning how to code, all in an afternoon. I've spent countless hours online, researching and troubleshooting. My curiosity led me to a diverse community of makers and creatives right in my own backyard. Vancouver is witnessing a sharp rise in DIY, or do-it-yourself, culture. More and more people are turning to their peers and sort of crowdsourcing knowledge to deepen their understanding of the natural world, empower themselves with new skills, and reconnect to their local communities. I spoke with five DIYers about what it is they're up to and what makes them tick. Along the way, I was hoping to discover why the DIY movement is on such a rise. Meet Aaron Udall, an environmental educator running the beekeeping programs for the Environmental Youth Alliance. With a background in conservation biology, Aaron specializes in creating programs that inspire youth to become curious about their own backyards and encourage environmental stewardship.
I was in university and I really didn't have any sort of knowledge or connection to bees, and I got a summer internship, and in the interview the professor opened up a box of bees and I was just totally hooked. The different species will blow your mind. There's different colors you've never even imagined, sizes, body shapes, and then when you go out in the field and you see these organisms in action and all the different species interacting with different kinds of flowers, you realize the intricacy of those symbiotic relationships. You could study your whole life and not know a fraction of what there is to know about bees.
Ethnobotanist Bryce Watts is a lover of plants. He's a founding member of Forager Foundation, a local organization committed to promoting global cultural heritage. He leads public foraging tours in and around Vancouver, educating people on the wild foods that can be found locally.
It started from my grandpa on my mom's side. I was really young when he would take us out into the forest. He lived in rural Alberta, and so he would always point out little berries or little leaves. And it was great when you're a little kid, you're just running through the forest and you get to nibble on some berries every so often. Didn't really pay any attention to it, though, or didn't realize that it had an impact on me. And then I ended up working in a greenhouse company just out of high school and found out, okay, I love plants. And then, actually, it was pretty much just a year ago that I remembered my grandpa taking us into the forest, and it kind of clicked, okay, that's where the love started. It's generations that have built upon generations for knowing what you can use and what's something to stay away from, and so it's definitely working off of the people that have come before us.
Ben Coley's love affair with Belgian beer began roughly a decade ago, after a fateful trip to Antwerp. Building up his knowledge through a combination of brewing school, beer sabbaticals to Belgium, and persistent home brewing, Ben opened up Doggerod Brewing in Burnaby in 2014.
Homebrewing at first was a friend of mine had the idea. It sounded like drinking a lot of beer in the backyard, which I was, you know, into. So there were four of us making these little like 20-liter batches of beer. I think we drank more beer while we were brewing than we actually made at first. Gradually, my homebrewing crew of four of us whittled down to three of us, and then two of us, and then me alone. And basically, I was just the nerdiest one. At first, I just, you know, was super excited to just be able to make beer. That just seemed like a magical thing to be able to do that. And then I just kind of went down the rabbit hole, internet research, buying books to figure out how to do it better, how to, you know, really figure out the processes and get everything nailed down so that I could get that exact flavor that I wanted. And then eventually, you know, I'd broken at this point two full carboys full of beer in my house. And my wife finally just said, you need to get a real brewery. You can't do this here anymore.
Excited by the creative possibilities that tools like 3D printers, laser cutters, and CNC routers offered, artist Julie Van Noyen became a fabricator at Maker Labs in Vancouver's East Side. The collective makerspace boasts 26,000 square feet of workshops, communal tools, and storefront, and offers classes to the public on the various tools and technologies available for use at the space.
I was a part-time student at Emily Carr, and I was really interested in kind of getting more into the art and design and fabrication world. I got involved with Maker Labs about a year ago. I was hired as a fabricator, so I primarily create custom fabrication projects for people using the tools that we have, which include 3D printers, laser cutters, a full wood shop, CNC routers, and I also teach classes on those same tools for people who are interested in using them on their own to create their own custom projects.
An avid traveler and son of a polyglot who speaks 16 languages, Mark Kaufman is the co-founder of Link, a web and app language learning platform. Passionate about autonomous education, Mark and his team have been developing a language learning system that breaks down common barriers for adult learners.
I had played pro hockey for 10 years, so I had been playing in different countries. And first year I played overseas, I played in Italy, and I still remember the feeling of arriving there and, okay, like, I don't know any Italian. And was a little bit surprised that pretty much no one spoke English in our little town. That's when you realize, yeah, you know what, I'm spending, you know, 6 months there, and you're playing a hockey team with local guys, and they're joking around, and you can ask people for translations, but it's not the same. You don't get the same out of it, out of the experience, if you can't start to understand and speak with them in their own language.
In speaking with each of these DIYers, I noticed that they shared a common curiosity about the world and how it works, something that compelled them to do the things they do. We love exploring and discovering new things. It's human nature. It's this curiosity that makes us innovators and creative problem solvers. An educational shift is taking place as a result of more and more people embracing their curious nature. A lot of learning is now taking place outside traditional classrooms, focused on immersing people in an experience, learning by doing. This hands-on approach is something Erin from the Environmental Youth Alliance is deeply passionate about. I caught up with her on a warm spring day at the EYA's Honey House in Strathcona Community Garden to find out what her program participants and the bees get up to.
Maybe could you describe what we're looking at?
Yeah, so this is a frame of what had honey on it last year and now is empty because we removed all the honey. And it is wax comb that just has little entrails of honey all over it. It's very sticky on my fingers and made of wood. The other essential thing that you need as a beekeeper is a smoker. Try to use the smoker as least amount as possible, but it kind of is just this kind of old looking contraption where you put in some old cloth or something into the bottom of it, get the lid on tight, and you light a fire in this thing, and then you blow smoke into the hives, and it just stops their receptors in their antenna from picking up different signals that if they did want to go after you for whatever reason, then it confuses them a little bit.
What's in the top there?
We just have put grass in the top to prevent, or just kind of blocks the smoke when we put it away the last time, so that no fire is going to get out. So this is bits of wax that we save off of the hive. This dark stuff smells very earthy. Kind of, it's probably been smoked a number of times. The bees have reused this wax over and over again to put honey in, to lay their eggs. And so it has, yeah, quite an earthy tone to it.
Passionate about youth education, Erin shared with me the experience of young participants that enter the beekeeping program each year.
The general attitude of youth coming into our programs is they're excited and they're also nervous. They don't know what to expect. How they're taught from adults is, you know, you're limited in certain ways. Like, you can do this up to a point. And we are, like, trusting them and giving them access to bees, which is a pretty intimate experience, and it can be a scary experience. So we spend a lot of time talking about that before, of course, we let them go in there. But yeah, they're really excited and curious and nervous. So we deal with that nervousness in a very direct way by talking about getting stung by bees, what that feels like, what is the role of bees in our ecosystem. Lots of things like that before we go into the hive, and we build up a level of respect for these organisms. Our tagline is helping youth discover their inner nature, and I really feel that, like, that sums it up.
Many people can relate to a time when they've jumped into something new and exciting and then suddenly felt in over their heads. Addressing that fear and uncertainty is an important part of the DIY learning process. And making mistakes and facing the consequences offer great learning opportunities.
When you go into the hive, if the bees are in a good mood, like, it's very unlikely that you would get stung, but you never know. Sometimes you'll open up the hive and you'll know immediately, like, they're having a bad day. They are not happy to see you.
So getting stung is kind of part of the job.
Yeah, it's definitely a rite of passage for every beekeeper to get stung. Next, we are going outside. And we're in kind of a pretty industrial part of the city, but just in the back corner here of the garden, we have the beehives.
It looks like they're coming out.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spring day, so the bees are busy out collecting whatever pollen they can. When it's these first sunny days, they're pretty low on stores of food right now, so they're going to be just gathering whatever they can to bring back to the hive so that they can start to grow their colony again for the spring. So you can see as the bees are flying in here, some of them already have great loads of pollen on their legs that they're bringing back into the hives.
Bumbling around with the city bees for an afternoon got me thinking about other ways to connect with and learn from life in my own backyard. Having lived in Vancouver's West End for many years, I've always admired the beauty of the neighborhood, but hadn't realized the bounty that existed at the city's edge until Bryce took me for a foraging walk through Stanley Park one sunny afternoon.
So we're taking a little walk around Beaver Lake in Stanley Park today. It's a nice sunny day and warm spring-like weather, so we're going to be looking at some native plants and maybe sampling a little bit here and there just to see a little taste of what could be grown in the spring. So this is a western hemlock here. It's got nice, small, rounded needles on it, and if you look at a side profile, you'll notice that they're quite flat. In the springtime, when you see the nice, bright green new growth on it, if you take that and just give it a little nibble, it's a really nice lemon, citrusy kind of kick to it. And because the needles are quite tough, it's not really something you would eat. It's something that you'd use as a flavoring, so similar to how you would use rosemary. So this plant here is the salal. It's a really common bush along the coast. The new growth in the spring is a really bright yellowish green color, and that's really nice in a tea. It has a citrusy flavor to it, and it's good for cold and flu symptoms. We like to do things hands-on. We could do in the classroom for the plant walks through the spring and summer, but actually getting out and seeing them and being able to touch them and sometimes even taste the berries and smell the flowers is definitely a better learning experience. People are usually quite enthusiastic about one particular plant that they saw. Maybe it was surprising to them that they could eat it, or it was something that they'd tried before, but they'd found other uses that they hadn't thought of. And so it's just showing them what they can actually do with those ingredients, and people have been really excited about that. So we just walked down the stairs and we're actually on the beach now along the seawall, checking out some of the seaweeds that grow pretty close to the city. So this is the rockweed that grows all along the seawall, and it has really nice little air pockets at the end of each little frond that make a nice Cheeto if you snip off the air bubble, season it, rinse it off, and then season it, and then dehydrate them. It's the same sort of consistency as a Cheeto. And so that one's definitely my favorite. The disconnect from what you see in the grocery store and what's actually happening in the fields is harmful if you're not really paying attention. And so I think getting people to have that reintegration of knowing where the food is or having a hands-on approach to producing that food is really helping for pushing back against some of those destructive habits.
Spending time getting to know the urban ecosystem opened my eyes to another way of existing in the city. DIYers like Aaron and Bryce are keen to share traditional knowledge and practices in the hope of repairing that broken relationship city dwellers often have with the environment. Aaron is motivated to help youth write a new narrative that shifts our species' role from destroyers to nurturers.
What I like about the work that I do with youth is that I'm just a facilitator. The outdoor environment is the teacher, and I'm just kind of this in-between to show people the natural connection that they already have to nature. So that curiosity is innate. It's already inside of everyone. We try to kind of give them this horrible story about the environment and then move along. They have a lot to say about those feelings and the reconciliation that I think we're all kind of desiring around nature. And bees are kind of this symbolic organism that represents that whole story. Bees are something that we are kind of afraid of, but we need so badly in our lives. When people start to learn about bees, I feel like their minds open to other avenues of accepting themselves and nature in a new way.
These guys I haven't seen in quite a while, but they're sure busy. These bees, I can even just tell that they're from a different hive because the coloration of their bodies is a little bit darker. These ones are a bit more aggressive.
Stung?
I think so. Sometimes you can't tell for a minute. Kind of a good opportunity to talk about one other thing, though, is when you do get stung by a bee, there is a really cool plant in your own garden that can help you with it. Here we go. I'm just going to pick this plant, and then
so you've just made a bit of a paste with that leaf.
Yeah.
With your saliva.
With my saliva. So it's a mix of saliva and ground up plant. And I'm just going to rub it right on my neck where I might have just gotten stung. So it's actually just something that like grows in our driveways, and we often rip it up as a weed. And plantain is a native plant that takes away stings and burns.
You feeling better?
Yep. It's great. It's like a magic little fix. And it's, I always think it's kind of funny that it's growing like right beside where the bees are. It's like it's meant to be.
Seeing Aaron's calm and resourceful reaction to getting stung convinced me that these types of skills really are applicable to daily life and make us feel empowered. There's nothing like a firsthand experience to get you motivated. With something less tangible, like language learning, finding motivating factors can be tough.
The biggest differences between classroom and app learning are that in the classroom, first of all, you're reliant on the teacher to set the pace, and you are affected by the other students in the class, so that efficiency in that setting is not high. Elon Musk said, if I want to learn something, I read up on it or I research it myself. I don't go to class because class has too slow a download speed. When you're an autonomous learner, you decide what you're going to learn from. So hopefully you're choosing material that's of interest to you, which means you're going to do better.
Everyone from tech entrepreneurs to Spanish students are seeking out self-guided ways to learn new skills and access information that is relevant to them. Nowadays, you can find a video tutorial for just about anything on YouTube, solving problems and answering nagging questions in a matter of minutes. Creatives like Julie of Maker Labs are leveraging this growing trend of self-study to help get their projects off the ground.
My two greatest teachers when I was hired at Maker Labs were Google and YouTube, and I've learned to do pretty much everything that I've learned to do in the shop on there. And I've at least, gotten my ideas and gotten started, and then there's someone around with the skills to kind of show me how it's done or I can figure it out. I think because we have access to so much information now, we're really kind of hitting our stride in how to best exploit that. You know, when you're in the classroom setting, for the teacher to role model learning alongside their students is actually a far more powerful way to teach than to talk at the kids as if, they're the expert and the kids need to learn from them. Seeing their teacher learn alongside them and prototype and kind of seeing that creative agility is actually one of the best ways to learn, I think.
One of the workshops Julie teaches at Maker Labs is 3D printing. Recent advancements with the technology have brought it to the forefront of DIY culture, with high-profile companies like Elon Musk's SpaceX using 3D printed rocket engine parts. The low cost of 3D printers and the use of open-source software is driving their popularity, making them the prototyping tool of choice. Curious to see what all the fuss was about, I headed down to the expansive Maker Labs workshop in East Van, where Julie walked me through the process of additive manufacturing with a 3D printer.
We are now on location at Maker Labs in Vancouver. I've got my laptop hooked up to one of our plastic fused deposition modeling 3D printers. So these are the MakerBot clone printers. It's an Imaginator plastic 3D printer that prints little plastic parts. I've got a model of a chess castle or rook that I'm going to start printing to kind of show you how it works.
You just told me he has a name, right?
Yeah, so, we don't want him to just be a number. This is Bill. As you can see, Bill has a nice set of googly eyes and a name tag here. We have several 3D printers, and sometimes they might not be feeling their best, or there might be one that's, really doing good that day. So it helps to differentiate between them and kind of call them by name. And I might let my coworker know that Bill's having a particularly rough day. And so maybe try the one on the right is actually to the power of two. We have a little mathematical symbol up there that we 3D printed.
So sometimes Bill needs a coffee break.
Sometimes, yeah. So you can see the bed here is just getting ready for that print to lay its first layers. Oh. There we go, it's telling us it's ready. So if you look closely on the bed there, it's starting to lay down the first layer of plastic. So this build, now that it seems to be, it's sticking nicely to the bed, it'll take around 2.5 to 3 hours to get this little guy fully built. This model is about 3 inches tall. But once you're confident that the first few layers have kind of laid down nice and flat and they're adhering and everything, you can kind of walk away and just come check on it every once in a while.
I think one of the kind of hallmarks of the maker movement and one of the best things about it is that pretty much anyone can learn how to make pretty much anything. There's definitely a sense of empowerment, the idea that they can create something that they always maybe thought of as being made in a factory somewhere else overseas, and now it's something that they can, you know, whip up, and excitement at being able to create these things and share what they've made with other people. Yeah, and just surprised that these things can be accessible now, because they're just easier to use now, and the cost is low enough now that, you know, everyone really has access. And it kind of relates to the widespread global maker movement, where all of these places are just springing up everywhere kind of simultaneously because of a definite kind of need for the access to tools and creating.
I'm just going to check back on Bill here.
Our print is completed. I'm just going to try to pull this little guy off the bed. Okay, so this is our rook here, and you can see there's a piece of plastic on the bottom here that actually helps hold it down to the bed. It's called a raft, so I'll just pull that off. And we could just put this in the to-be-recycled plastic bin here. And here he is.
Very majestic.
Yeah, so we're working our way towards a full chess set. So maybe next time you're here, we can play.
It's going to take many hours to create that, isn't it?
Yeah. Although, whenever I teach the 3D printing and scanning class, I'll do another chess piece. So, I don't know. I've taught it quite a few times now. Although, so far, I've only made rooks. So, time to move on to another piece.
You might have a surplus.
Yeah. Doesn't hurt to have extras in case someone falls in the line of duty.
Whether you're building rocket engine parts or a chess set, creating something yourself is a fulfilling process. There's something satisfying about seeing a project through from start to finish and being able to say you built it and understand how it works. Ben shared with me how the decision to start his own brewery stemmed from this need.
Another thing I think people are looking for is a connection to the production. I mean, you know, a connection to the locality of it, and to be able to sit in the tasting room and talk to the brewer, you know, when we pass through. You know, you think about the modes of, and methods of production in a globalized economy, the exact opposite of craft brewing, or the exact opposite of actually making something yourself, is the factories in China where they make hockey sticks. These people don't even know what they're for often. They make products in all these factories all the way across the developing world where they don't even know what the product is. It's just meaningless. You know, you're just there performing a function. Whereas on the DIY scale or the craft brewing scale, you can actually go down there and see how the product is made and meet the person who made it. And the person who made it is making it for you, but he's also making it for himself. It changes the meaning of the production, but it inevitably makes the product better. That person's brewing the beer he's going to drink. Like, he cares about this beer.
Doggerod's Mitch Warner is one such brewer. Passionate about crafting the perfect pint, Mitch gave me a glimpse into the brewing process on site in Burnaby. When I arrived, he was already busy at the mash tun, vigorously stirring the mixture inside the large stainless steel tank with a long wooden paddle.
So this is our very authentic Belgian beer mash paddle, custom made by a friend of a friend, and I'm going to stir the mash.
And tell us what's in the mash.
So today we're brewing our Belgian-style table beer called Bernabarian, and it is mostly German Pilsner malt with oat flakes. It's a very light beer. It's 4.5%, but you don't want that watery taste when you're drinking a 4.5% beer. So you add some oats, and the oats kind of give it a bit of body and perception of, like, overall mouthfeel.
So what's in the mash right now, or what's happening with it?
So we've got the grains coming down through the auger, and then there's a hydration collar in which hot water is sprayed into, hydrating the grains as they fall into the mash tun. And once they're in the mash tun, the temperature reaches a point at which a specific enzyme will start breaking down complex carbohydrates into simple fermentable sugars.
And tell us what we're standing in front of here.
So this is our brew control panel. It has the temperature of our mash tun, hot liquor tank, brew kettle, and as well as controllers for the heater of the hot liquor tank and the burner and the brew kettle. We also have a pump that is variable speed. So you can dial it from 1 up to 60 hertz, and that'll change the speed at which you're pumping the liquid, whether it be